Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. First, congratulations to us. My Larry Summers is 0-for-6 informational campaign was part of a broad-based effort to keep a Wall Street fixer, that is, someone who, whenever he was in government, made sure Wall Street got what it wanted to the detriment of the rest of the country, to keep that sort of person from heading the Federal Reserve Bank of our country, in spite of all the many failures on his factual record. And that's what our informational campaign was about here. I drew together 6 of Summers' factual failures on his record because I found it exasperating that the mainstream media never mentioned any but one of them. And I asked you to send that or circulate it to anyone you knew working in mainstream media. Well, and they did start popping up, by the way, those examples. It's all over now, but this does make one wonder in the aftermath about President Obama's druthers. So regarding a remaining ongoing campaign on this program, and speaking of President Obama's druthers, you may have seen in the media a couple of days ago that the chief U.S. trade representative, Michael Froman, has been in Europe quite recently, and maybe still is, trying to convince the EU to lower its environmental standards such that the oil processed from the very gunky tar sands oil in Alberta could be exported to Europe after being piped across the United States from Canada to Port Arthur, Texas. What does this tell you about whether the Obama administration is in favor of the XL pipeline? Talk about the fixes in. This issue, should our water systems be endangered by piping the gunky Alberta tar sands over our land and our groundwater supply simply so a few people can make money on exports, is the same issue at the heart of the fracking debate. And by the way, if you are involved in trying to stop fracking in your state, do not let the fracking company's spokespeople get away with saying in hearings, as they have in California, and saying to the press that they've been fracking for decades in the United States with no problems. Well, they may well have been drilling with pressurized water and some benign chemicals, but all that changed with the infamous U.S. Energy Policy Act of 2005. Into which then Vice President Dick Cheney managed to have slipped a sentence that says, the extraction procedure known as hydraulic fracturing is henceforth removed from the jurisdiction of the U.S. Clean Water Act. Only at that point did hundreds of new fracking companies spring up across the country using very toxic chemicals. The domestic market for natural gas, therefore, became glutted, and that wasn't supposed to happen. So the price dropped, and that caused most of these new fracking companies to switch to an export model. So our precious groundwater supply is threatened solely so that a few people can make export profits. And one more thing, if you're involved in this struggle locally, I hope you've heard that the fracking study that was funded by the much compromised Environmental Defense Fund, plus several oil and gas corporations, a study that supposedly found that not as much methane was released into the atmosphere at the top of fracked wells as was previously thought, a study that was somehow published in the Proceedings Journal of the National Academy of Sciences on September 16th, this study has been strongly critiqued by scientists and engineers for its methodology and conclusions. So do not let the companies get away with waving that article around in hearings. And you can find the critiques online. As for our other ongoing campaign, I'll return to that one next time. But today, we're going to hear about a grassroots campaign to protect our children from being targeted by sneaky, relentless advertising by the corporations who make cheap-to-produce, junk, addictive food. This matter is situated, though, in the larger issue of how well America is raising its children. That, of course, is one of the benchmarks for how a society in general is doing. How well does it care for the young and usher them into adult participation in that culture? Regarding our country, here are a few current indicators. An overview study was done of 72 studies that had been conducted between 1979 and 2009. This was published about 24 months ago. It found that college students today express a level of empathy that is 40% lower than what was measured 30 years ago. Yeah, a lot less relating to what other people are going through, even paying attention to it or taking it in or having any response. A lot less of that. What does that mean for the society? This is, of course, related, this callousness, to the increase in bullying that's now widely known but not really well understood. And now the media periodically reports that a high school student, such as Bart Palos in Greenwich, Connecticut, or even a middle school student, such as 12-year-old Rebecca Sedgwick in Lakeland, Florida, committed suicide after classmates had bullied, tormented, and repeatedly urged the targeted child to kill him or herself. Where is this moral depravity coming from? And at such a young age, what's happening? I mean, certainly the media and violent video games are part of the cause, but young children are picking up lots of very wrong cues very early from many sources in our culture, near and far to them. I was glad to see an overview article in the New York Times on Sunday, September 11th, about various programs used in schools now, elementary schools and middle schools, to teach emotional intelligence. But remember, at home, even if you're an overworked, stressed parent struggling to make ends meet, and lots of people are today through no fault of their own, your children need to bask in your full attention on them for at least a little while every day in order to be well-grounded psychologically. Don't do any multitasking during that period. Just radiate your full attention on them and listen to them. And another area of indicators, though, how are we doing on keeping our children healthy? What's happening with our children physically? What's causing the high rates of allergies, learning disabilities, depression, sleeping disorders, and autism spectrum disorder, as well as Asperger's? By the way, if you're interested in seeing a concise snapshot of the physical condition of American children today, I drew together a lot of the relevant data on that in a section in the chapter on health and healthcare in my book, Relational Reality. Well, what could be causing such epidemic levels of problems with brain chemistry or with the brain and the nervous system? I mean, for something that widespread, it certainly looks as if it might be caused by environmental toxins disrupting conception or fetal development. Even a little has a big effect. So is our country mounting an urgent investigation into that so that we could head off the lifelong suffering for more and more children? No, we're not. Not that I've noticed. The children continue to be sacrificed because the corporations in several sectors do not want to see such an investigation and the removal of environmental toxins from our air, soil, water, and food supply. Without campaign finance reform that would really get money out of elections, every vote in Washington and every state capital will continue to be bought, and the children, along with everyone else, will be the losers. However, sometimes things come up from the state level, which are not quite in the grip that D.C. is in. And I'm very pleased to be able to share some good news in this area on a state level, which could be a model. And that is that the LA Times reported this morning that, as they put it, the rules are changing for many consumer products. Regulators will unveil a sweeping program for reformulating items with toxic chemicals. And it says hundreds of items found on supermarket shelves, such as shampoos, cleaning supplies, cosmetics, food packaging, could get chemical makeovers under new rules being put into force by the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. Do you have one of those departments in your state government? Try to get one if you don't. The Department of Toxic Substances Control. So on Thursday, these regulators will unveil what they say is the nation's most comprehensive program for identifying and reformulating common consumer products containing hazardous chemicals. In the past, the state of California took a piecemeal approach. Lawmakers would ban specific chemicals from particular products, such as bisphenol A in baby bottles and sippy cups. But that's being replaced by a more systematic approach now. Under the new rules, which go into effect on October 1st, the state will identify classes of products for review, such as nail polish. Manufacturers will then have to perform detailed analyses to justify whether hazardous chemicals are needed or whether substitutes are available. This is more like the EU approach. You know, here's this list of safe chemicals. Why aren't you using them instead? So that is truly good news. And I'm also happy to say that, fortunately, grassroots efforts are focusing on important parts of this larger problem, even though we have gridlock and corporate dominance in D.C., problems such as addressing the way that our children can grow up eating healthy food and taking on the dynamics that are blocking that. This is a hugely important area, and my guest today, Anna LaPay, is one of the leaders in this movement. She's an author and educator known for her work on food systems and for advocating sustainable food. With her mother, Frances Moore LaPay, who was on this program last fall, by the way, September 13th, if you'd like to listen to that, in the free PRN archives. With Frances Moore LaPay, Anna LaPay co-founded the Cambridge-based Small Planet Institute, an international network for research and popular education about the root causes of hunger and poverty. The LaPays are also co-founders of the Small Planet Fund, which has raised nearly $1 million for democratic social movements worldwide. Anna LaPay is the author or co-author of 3 books and is contributing author to 10 others. Her latest book, Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It, was named by Booklist and Kirkus as one of the best environmental books of the year. Anna is also co-author of Hope's Edge, which chronicles social movements fighting hunger around the world, and Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen, which showcases ecological and social benefits of sustainable food and even has seasonal menus. Anna's work has been widely translated internationally and featured in many periodicals. She can also be seen as the co-host of the public television series The Endless Feast, and as a featured expert on PBS's Need to Know, the Sundance Channel's Big Ideas for a Small Planet, and the PBS documentary Nourish. Anna is a regular guest on nationally syndicated radio shows and has been on hundreds of those, including now, All Together Now. A frequent public speaker in the past decade, she's participated in more than 600 public events, lectures, fundraisers for the food movement. She holds a master's degree in economic and political development from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, graduated with honors from Brown. In 2004 to 2006, she was a food and society policy fellow at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. She lives in the Bay Area with her husband and daughters. She was named in Time Magazine's Eco Who's Who. and she's currently directing the Real Food Media Project. Anna LaPay, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Charlene. It's so wonderful to be here, although as a mother to two young daughters, listening to your opening was just heartbreaking. but it's the reality, and it's important that we know it and we talk about it.
Yeah, well, what you're doing in this one big area needs to be replicated in all those areas, because I just can't understand. Well, it's almost as if it's too bad people are focused on the collapse of the economy and the catastrophic climate crisis, because no one's really looking at what's happening physically to people in this country. But as my husband reminded me, all three of those are connected.
Totally connected, absolutely.
Before we get into your work with the Real Food Media Project, I'd like to begin by asking you to tell the listeners about your most recent book, Diet for a Hot Planet.
Sure, and speaking of all of those connections, the genesis of the book was really my own curiosity. I had uncovered a few years ago a report that looked at the global impact of our food system in terms of climate change, and it was from the United Nations, and it found that when you look at just livestock production alone, you're talking about a greenhouse gas impact of about 17% to 20% of all greenhouse gas emissions are really being driven by livestock production. And that got me scratching my head and asking more questions and really curious about understanding this huge ecological toll of our food system, and primarily this industrial, highly petroleum-based, chemical-based food system. And when you connect all the dots, you find that globally the food system produces about one-third of all greenhouse gas emissions. So the book is really about helping people understand that, helping people understand that if we're serious about addressing the climate crisis, food has to be a central part of that conversation. And that was originally what the book was about, and is still a lot of what the book is. But as I started doing that research, what I found was this incredibly hopeful story, which is a story of what farmers are doing and can do on the land, and how when you look at the benefits of sustainable farming, you find that one of the key benefits is that a healthy, resilient, sustainable farm has incredibly carbon-rich soil. Mm-hmm. You find that a sustainable farm has incredible biodiversity. You find that a sustainable farm has more ability to retain water in times of drought and withstand floods in times of heavy rainfall. In other words, sustainable farmers are a key part of solving the climate crisis, as well as helping us ensure that we have a food supply into the future. So the book also, I hope, and readers have told me that it's also this hopeful story.
It is, because it shows all these beneficial connections, you know, instead of we're worried about identifying the dangerous connections that slip by. So, folks, again, that was Diet for a Hot Planet. And now, to get to your current project, including this national launch last night of the new video, as far as I can figure out, it's kind of like Russian dolls nestled one in the other. So I'm going to start with Small Planet Institute. I went first to your website there, and that's a very interesting website. I would particularly like to draw people's attention to that timeline you have up, about 40 years of the food movement. So it makes very clear when the different events, developments, organizations sprang into being. Frankly, I was looking at that and I thought, gee, I wonder if Michael Pollan has looked at this. It might be eye-opening.
Right, this has been going on for a long time.
Never mind, it has.
I was going to say, you know, I'm glad you brought up that timeline. I think a lot of what my mother and I have find ourselves gravitating toward in our work is driven by this idea that we cannot create what we cannot believe is possible, and that part of what is empowering to all of us is seeing that map of where we are headed, but also that map of where we've been. And so that timeline was our way to say, let's look at all of what has been created and understand that while, yes, we might be up against huge expansion of fracking. And yes, we might be up against this continuing use of really toxic chemicals on our farmland and so many other things that are really current crises that we also need to remind ourselves that we have come a long way, that we've had real successes, and that we will have those successes in the future.
Yeah. Also, just to keep the collective memory alive, because it's been very frustrating to me at my ripe old age to look back at this 40 years of activism and open magazines and seeing people reinventing the wheel, you know.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, it's completely disappeared from from their cognizance. They don't, you know, even see that this was what we thought was foundational. So I think it's very important to, in a very engaging, simple, visual way, make that all very, very clear. And it's just, it's inspiring to see it. You know, it's still building, definitely, and expanding. So I think, if I have this right, the Real Food Media Project is a project affiliated with Small Planet Institute, correct? Or not?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly, yes.
Mm-hmm. And this is, it says it's a new initiative to spread the story of our food with creative movies, an online movie contest, web-based action center, grassroots events. And in it, on that website, which is foodmyths.org, yes?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. FOODMYTHS. org. It says that you divide your work into five different areas. So by way of orienting us before we get into this new film on advertising, could you tell us about these areas? The first one is hunger and food security.
Sure. So and to just give a little bit of context for how the Food Mythbusters, as we like to call ourselves, how we started, the genesis was really that after working for more than 12 years on talking and about food and writing about food and trying to help people understand all these connections that you and I have already been talking about today, what I found is that no matter where I went, and I've done hundreds of talks all around the country, that I heard the same questions over and over and over again from audience members, questions about, well, how can we really feed the world? Can organic agriculture really do that? Questions like, well, you know, aren't genetically modified foods more ecological because they allow us to use less chemicals? Questions like, well, do young people really want to eat healthy food? Aren't you just being a food nanny telling them what to eat? Those kinds of questions kept coming up no matter where I went. And at the same time, I was also, I love reading food industry press. So, you know, what the industry says to itself and, you know, how the industry talks about the work that it does. And what I was finding is that there was a direct parallel between what I was hearing from audience members and literally the talking points of the food industry. So what is that full-page ad that Monsanto takes out in the New Yorker magazine? It's an ad that says, we need genetically modified foods to feed the world, essentially. That is the question I'm hearing from my audience member, and on and on and on. And so I was really compelled to create a place that would generate new media through movies and through grassroots events and through other means to help people really arm themselves with the information to think differently about those talking points, to bust those myths that the food industry is putting out there. Mm-hmm. So our first movie came out last year, busting, I think, the mama myth of all, which is that we need chemical agriculture to feed the world. Mm-hmm. And we took that on in a 6.5-minute movie with our allies and partners. And then this year we're launching our next movie, which debuted on yesterday. We launched with a movie taking on this myth that what kids eat is just about parental choice and really trying to expose the harmful impact of food marketing. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit of the context of how we got here and what we're trying to do with our movies.
Mm-hmm. So I'll just name these if people want to go look at it. These areas that you're working in eventually probably have materials in all five of these: hunger and food security, cost and economics, food safety and health, the environment, and our topic for today, marketing and advertising. So I was, even though I thought I knew a little bit, pretty shocked by a lot of the facts that you present in this short video. Could you tell us about you know, how you present the big picture, because I think you do a very good job of that, and your emphasis running throughout is they try to put this on parents, say, if you don't, you know, tell your children they can't eat these sugary, high-fat, high-salt things, then they'll be healthy. But you have this little scene in the film, animated, where the child is saying, please, Mommy, please, Mommy, please, Mommy. I thought, oh, my gosh, that's so familiar from when my daughter was a little girl. So, yeah, why don't you lead the audience into the themes of that video?
Sure. So the overarching theme is to really add my voice to this conversation, this national conversation about marketing to kids, and to really get people to, and sometimes shock people, as you're saying, you were shocked, but to shock people to see just how prevalent marketing to kids is, and also to understand why it's a problem, to understand that, you know, we now know, and studies are showing us, that there's this direct correlation between marketing to kids and what children consume and their brand loyalties that can last a lifetime. And we know that, therefore, there is this direct connection between this really prevalent food marketing and the diet-related illnesses that are skyrocketing in this country.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that surprised me the most, because I hadn't been tracking that, I don't have an elementary-age child now, but the sneaky ways that the corporate presence has come into the public school system. Can you say something about that?
Sure, yeah, and I, honestly, I thought I knew a lot about what the food industry is doing, and I was so shocked to find out how much they're infiltrating our schools. So when I talk about marketing to kids, the number one thing people say to me is, well, Anna, just turn off your television, or, hey, I don't have a TV, I don't have to worry about that. And what I say to those parents is television is just the tip of the iceberg. It's just a tiny fraction of how the food industry is marketing. And one of the very sneaky ways they do it, as I talk about in the movie, is they are getting into our schools, these places that really should be sanctuaries from commercialization and sanctuaries from advertising. Companies are doing things like creating books that teachers use in the classroom, like Oreo cookie counting book. I mean, it's like a bad joke, but it's true. Or they're talking about doing things like a lot of schools have signed pouring rights with Pepsi or with Coke, where in exchange for a modicum of money, they agree to have exclusive pouring rights to one of those companies. As there's been pushback to that around the country, grassroots, really effective pushback, one of the things the soda industry has done, very sneaky things they've done, is transform how they market to children in schools and paint it as a form of charity. And it helps them get in without as much pushback, but ultimately, I would argue it's just as much marketing as direct marketing.
Absolutely.
Coke probably is like the leader in this with My Coke Rewards is one of these programs where you buy Coke products, you get points. And all around the country, I found parent-teacher association letters going out to parents to implore them to buy Coke products where their points could go to the school.
Oh, wait a minute. This is making my blood boil because there's a certain reason the school budgets are so desperate and fall for this. But we have to pause here for the break. We're going to pick up with this as soon as we come back. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Anna LaPay, on All Together Now on the Progressive Radio Network. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Anna LaPay. The website for her work with Real Food Media Project is foodmyths.org, and the website for Small Planet Institute is smallplanet.org. Before we get back into our subject, I just want to say that I remember an ad for the Berkeley Co-op groceries. Just to tell people what that was, there were three grocery stores in Berkeley for decades run by the co-op, membership-owned co-op. It was started in the beginning of the 19th century by Finnish immigrants in Berkeley who had a strong cooperative background. And there was an ad encouraging people to become members of the co-op, which featured you, about 10 years old, and your brother and your mother making cookies. So
really?
Yes. If you don't remember that, you may not remember that the co-op had their grocery cereals arranged in zones. And they had a red zone. All the ones that were put in that section were high sugar. And then they had one with a yellow strip across the top and bottom of the shelves, and that was the medium sugar laden. And then it had a green, smaller, of course, green zone with healthy cereals. So my daughter was always trying to, you know, nudge me into the yellow zone. But that was quite rare for, you know, people being on top of this problem way back then. Okay, let's go back to what they're doing with advertising. And I just want to say, before we get back into some of the hair-raising examples that people probably don't know about, the reason all our schools are now desperate for money to supplement their public budgets from the level of state universities, state colleges, community colleges, and K through 12 public school systems has to do with the huge hole that was blown in the revenue stream. So, you know, there was a big tax cut for the rich in the Reagan administration, and then with President Bush II, there was another big tax cut for the upper brackets around 2002. And this, as I say, just made a big absence of public revenue for infrastructure repair, for public education, for public health. And then you saw the colleges and universities having to keep putting the tuition up because they weren't getting support not only from the federal government, but a lot of states that have income tax, which is most of them, a lot of them peg their state income tax rate to the federal rate. So when the Republicans managed to drop that rate way down for all the upper brackets, the states then match that, and you have suddenly much less money for public education. And that's when the corporations come in and dangle this, as you say, modest amounts of money for allowing them to infiltrate our children's space with their corporate advertising. So, again, we can't get the tax base fixed without campaign finance reform. And we saw that a couple of years ago when President Obama was finally talking about his first campaign promise to fix that, to roll back the Bush tax cuts for the rich. And Speaker Pelosi's proposal was that he allow the tax cuts to remain for people making up to $1 million a year. Do you think those people need tax relief? No, that's where the sweet spot is for campaign contributions to the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party. And he finally let the tax cuts stay up to people making $250,000 a year. Why? Again, they want those campaign contributions. They need to keep the corporations and the people in the upper brackets happy. So we have to get money out of politics, or we'll never have any votes that aren't corrupted to keeping their system going and keeping themselves in power. Okay, so the schools are now vulnerable to these corporations swooping in, all kinds of corporations. We're talking about the food corporations today, the junk food, but just the presence, the corporate presence in children's lives is so much bigger than it used to be a few decades ago. One of the things I was interested in your pointing out was they also say, well, we can do these fundraising programs. And as you pointed out in the video, they have to sell these corporate products in order to be able to raise money for things like basketball and simple phys ed equipment.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. We did the math on this one promotion that my Coke Rewards had put out for a physical activity pack where your school would get some jump ropes and a basketball and a few whistles. I mean, it's a really, really modest amount of physical activity equipment. You would only need to buy 55,000 cans of Coke to get enough points to be able to earn your school that pack.
Oh.
So, I mean, it's beyond ridiculous. But I think one of the things that struck me as I was doing this research is that actually, in a way, the upside of the stinginess of these fundraisers that the corporations are putting out there to schools is that we're actually not talking about these companies giving that so much money to the schools that it makes it really impossible for them to extract themselves from this relationship. And we've seen this, that when there is parent pressure and parents asking questions about appropriateness of these kinds of relationships, that schools have really changed their policies. And, you know, a good example of it is a program that McDonald's runs for schools, again, one of these so-called fundraisers, where they organize something called McTeacher's Nights. So these are nights where franchises of McDonald's can organize a fundraiser where schools bring teachers in to literally flip burgers and make fries at a McDonald's. They encourage their school to go get their dinner at that McDonald's, and for 2 to 3 hours of that night, McDonald's franchise gives a certain percentage back to the school. And ultimately, we found the schools were getting, you know, a couple hundred dollars maybe for doing a fundraiser like this. In some cases, it worked out to less than a dollar per student. So again, you're not talking about these corporations even really being that generous with their dollars, that it really is about getting their brand to be associated with some of the people who children respect the most, their teachers, the people who work in their schools. And to me, I think schools are this place that should really be protected space from
Absolutely.
This kind of commercial
Absolutely.
Interest.
Well, I was happy to hear about some of those kindred organizations campaigns you mentioned at the end, which we'll get to. The last two areas I'd like to talk about are local laws that have taken this on. I was happy to see some examples of that, and then we'll move into what people can do via these campaigns. So you gave some examples of places that have passed laws against this?
Yeah, so there's some different ways that people are trying to figure out how to do some pushback around this rampant marketing to kids. And the reason why we have to do this in the local and state level here in the United States has to do with the fact that when President Reagan came into power, one of the very first things he did actually was reorganize the Federal Trade Commission, put in a new commissioner to head the FTC, and essentially take any teeth that the FTC had to regulate marketing to kids, to really play a forceful role in this space, and to take that away. So ever since then, we've really contended with what became complete deregulation in the marketplace for how much advertising companies can do targeted to children. Mm. And even today, we are still finding it even hard to get the FTC to put in place strong voluntary regulations, let alone really powerful regulations that would have any binding binding at all. So mm-hmm. what we're finding is that grassroots activists are figuring out different ways to make change in this area. One of the things that people can do, and we're seeing this happen in school districts across the country, is work with the wellness policy that every single school district in the United States has. Some of them are excellent, some of them are fine, but a lot of people don't even know that these policies exist. They're the policies that are crafted to really shape the school environment, particularly around food and health and wellness. And so we're seeing, and St. Paul is a great example of this, we're seeing cities and school districts using those wellness policies as a place to actually write in limiting and to some extent prohibiting marketing of sugary drinks or junk food to kids in school. So that's one thing that people are doing, and that has been effective.
Mm-hmm. And then there was something about in Maine and Quebec.
Yeah, so Quebec is a great example where you actually saw a government put in place a ban on marketing to children, and there are a number of other governments around the world that are doing a lot more than we are here in the United States. And what Quebec found is there's been great research over the years since that marketing ban went into effect. They found that it has had a demonstrable effect on how much fast food young people eat, and that one study found a 13% decrease from when the marketing ban went into effect until the study was done. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of times, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of times what you hear the food industry say is, you know, marketing, it doesn't really matter. It's really parents. It's really up to parents, and parents are the ones that are influencing their children. Mm-hmm. And what we know is that simply is not true, that marketing does make a difference. It does make kids prefer certain brands, and actually we're finding it makes not just kids, but all of us just consume more calories, period, to be exposed to food marketing.
Mm-hmm. I read that when First Lady Michelle Obama hosted that gathering for marketers about mm-hmm. marketing to kids unhealthy foods, that she'd been pressured by some grassroots groups to bring that into her fitness campaign. Were you some of the people leaning on her?
I wasn't personally one of those people leaning on her, but that's right. There's been a lot of support for what Michelle Obama has been doing and really putting the work she's done to put to the forefront this national crisis around childhood health. And at the same time, there's been some concerns about, you know, how much change are we really going to see with the kinds of policies that she's putting out there. And so there was some encouragement for her to bring marketing into the conversation. And she hosted this convening, as you mentioned, of 100 people, many of whom were some of the leaders in terms of advocates for childhood health, as well as executives from some of the biggest food and beverage companies, not just in the U.S., but in the world. And I was really encouraged to see that, although what I think we need to be really aware of is that what we are hearing from the food industry is a really clever PR spin that's saying, you know, yes, we also care about this, yes, we're working on it, and yes, we can make the change through self-regulation.
Oh, yeah.
We are able to police ourselves. And
yeah.
We've had decades of evidence come in to show us that self-regulation doesn't work. And I actually thought
right.
it was interesting that this convening that Michelle Obama, the First Lady, hosted last week came on the heels of a new study from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which basically found that self-regulation when it comes to marketing to kids has not worked and that it has actually fundamentally failed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just one more point on this. I mean, I think it's interesting for us to just really step back and ask ourselves, why do we feel differently about the food industry than we do, say, about the tobacco industry? I mean, when you think about when we had this public conversation about how to regulate tobacco, and especially how to regulate tobacco seeming like they were marketing to kids with things like Joe the Camel, we didn't put the tobacco industry at the table in those conversations. And so I'm just curious about why is it that we feel differently about the food industry when we think that you know, they can be at the table with us when we're having these conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it that we feel differently about, say, you know, why would we be aghast if we saw Shrek on a box of Marlboros, but we don't blink an eye when we see Shrek on a box of Twinkies?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of really getting people to ask that question, I think, that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. If maybe there are more of a public education campaign that everybody got it, okay, cigarettes kill via lung cancer, got that. But this metabolic syndrome that children are developing and pre-diabetic syndrome they're developing in their teenage years, these are life-threatening conditions. So it is, as you say, just every bit as serious. And yet
yeah.
it's out there in this amorphous, oh, well, some people get sick.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, I think this is it. I mean, this is what we know, and this is what's so grave about the situation, is that the Centers for Disease Control reports that diet-related illnesses are leading to almost as many deaths as tobacco-related illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention just the loss of quality of life. I remember one study I read years ago that just broke my heart that was of children living with childhood cancer and children living with high rates of obesity. And they found that the children who were extremely overweight were more depressed than those who were suffering from cancer. You're just talking about a level of loss of quality of life that I think has to be part of the conversation. You know, when I talk to pediatricians who are telling me that they're seeing children come into their practice whose bones are no longer able to support their weight because they are so overweight, I mean, that is heartbreaking, and it's completely preventable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, before we move into these campaigns, it's funny you should say broke your heart, because I was just about to say that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so impressed with this work, truly, but there's just one concern I have that breaks my heart, and that's whenever I hear the modern usage debasing the word myth to mean lie. Because actually myth refers to that expansive ritual space in which humans cross-culturally have entered into communion with our larger context. So I know you're just mirroring current usage, but I just want to put it out there for you to maybe think about in the future.
No, I think I love that. Yeah, no, I think that's a really good thing for me to think about, and I think you're right. I mean, you know, that how is it that we make sense of our world? It's through stories and it through that the traditional understanding of myth is being part of that.
Yeah, well, we sure do need a lot of synonyms for corporate lies, that's for sure. We don't have enough. And before we leave this, I just want to say that one example was that I think it was in Florida, public school system was bribed to put the McDonald's logo on report cards. Was
mm-hmm.
that right?
Yep. Oh. That is right. Shocking, shocking but true. Another shocking but true example of what the food industry is doing. And what's in a way great about that example is that parents actually reached out to the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood and enlisted them to help them to make a stand and say this is unacceptable. And the campaign did work with parents in that community, and the school district thought twice about using McDonald's in such a way and no longer do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have just about a minute and a half left, so for these campaigns you won't be able to explain them, but if you tell a little bit and give the website, people can look at them, like Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood and Retire Happy Meals. What are some of these things people can do now?
Sure. Well, the number one thing that I just like to put out there is that as overwhelming as everything we're talking about is, that there is so much that we can do. So number one, just do not give in to the feeling of hopelessness. The other thing people can do if they want is they can join us and sign on to our kind of number one take action point. We're putting out there post the launch of our movie, which is to call on McDonald's to shut down HappyMeal.com, which is their premier place where they are targeting children online. And McDonald's is really an industry leader in terms of what it does to marketing to children. The rest of the industry follows. And so we're calling on McDonald's to be a leader in a different way and to lead by showing that this kind of predatory online marketing is not acceptable. So we put a petition out there, and we're looking for people to join us in that. The other thing people can do is look at what's happening in your community and connect locally with groups working on these issues, or do what those folks in Florida did, which is if you see something happening in your community around marketing to children in schools, for instance, to reach out to the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood. It has a long history of working with grassroots activists to get real wins on the ground.
Great.
And then the other thing that I would mention, my other key partner in this work is a fabulous organization called Corporate Accountability International. And they, like Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood, work with grassroots activists around the country and have also had some great success doing things like, for instance, getting McDonald's out of hospitals. Yes, there are McDonald's inside hospitals across the country, and public health officials have worked with Corporate Accountability International to cancel those contracts with that fast food chain, and working in other ways in communities across the country.
Mm-hmm. Just one thing. At an older level, a friend of mine in Ohio teaches eighth grade, and he used to teach, you know, how to decode advertising and commercials so the children would know what's being done to fool them, to lure them into certain thinking patterns. Is that ever done with these younger children, like you showed in the film? They're using certain colors. They're using red and orange. They know you like that. They're using, you know, stuffed animals and animals you like just to trick you into eating this food that's bad for you. I mean, is there any, like, decoding so that children are going to read ads, or would that come later?
Yes. No, I mean, I think, well, the advertising comes so early, the decoding can come so early. I mean, my own daughter, I have a 4-year-old and a 1.5-year-old, and the 4-year-old, I can't even remember where we happened to see Ronald McDonald, an image of Ronald McDonald. And she said, "Who's that?" And I said, "Oh, that's a clown that's trying to get kids to eat food that's bad for them." And we sort of laughed about how ridiculous that was. And,
okay.
And then she saw the clown again, and she said, "Oh, that's that clown, Mom." So, I mean,
All right.
You can talk to your children children at even, you know, the ripe young age of 3 or 4, for sure. But the decoding the media messages, I think, is key. And as much as we're trying to teach our children to be critical consumers of food, we need to teach them to be critical consumers of media.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, thank you so much. We're out of time now, but I want to thank you, Anna LaPay, for coming on the program.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
And come back sometime with future campaigns, because I'm really interested in this. All right, if you will.
Let's
move over to the Arts Corner now and see what we have, because Monday was the autumnal equinox. So let's hear a poem entitled Autumn by my man, William Morris. It's true he died in 1896, but he still speaks to us. So here's William Morris's Autumn. Laden autumn, here I stand, worn of heart, weak of hand. Naught but rest seems good to me. Speak the word that sets me free. Ah, William. Our song this week is September Song from 1938, written by Kirk Vile, lyrics by Maxwell Anderson. In this recording, it's sung by Billie Holiday. Here it is.
Oh, it's a long, long while from May to December, but the days grow short when you reach September, when the autumn weather turns the leaves to flame. One hasn't got for the waiting game. Oh, the days dwindle down to a precious few.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespratnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest, Mimi Silbert. founder and president of Delancey Street, a highly successful, well-known rehabilitation center in San Francisco. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Elizabeth Dodson Gray. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.
Now that we know it, let's be-